to come deep, you will understand why the curriculum fund was important in 1970.
The objective of the Capital Development Fund was to ensure that enough reserves are built to respond to the cost of build. And just to give you some examples of how significant this Capital Development Fund was, given the fact that Eskom was building massively in the 70s, we started seeing in the 70s double-digit increases, the highest of which was about 48.2% in 1977. A significant part of that increase, up to 30% of that increase, was responding to the Capital Development Fund in order to build reserves for the build program. And that was the case up until the mid-80s. So from the 70s to the mid-80s, Capital Development Fund responding to the big build of Eskom, being a huge significant cost of the increase during that time. And as I looked at history, the highest increase in South Africa was 48.2 in 1977, and as a result of the build program. In the early 80s, as a result of these huge increases, a commission was established to review electricity pricing in South Africa. And that commission was called the De Villiers Commission of 1983. It looked at pricing and also the impact of high increases on the economy. As a result of the De Villiers Commission, the Capital Development Fund was abolished. And the key outcomes of the De Villiers Commission was to say electricity, or the electricity industry, should be organized and its accounting should reflect any other company. This issue about it being used for economic development must come to an end. It must be priced according to commercial terms, and the funding of capital should be done like any other company. So that was the 1980s, and this led to the revision of the Electricity Act in 1987, abolishing the Capital Development Fund. What is important, Chairperson, is that since the 80s, we didn't have to build any infrastructure. So the outcome of the De Villiers Commission were never really tested to say, given that we have abolished the Capital Development Fund, have we replaced it with something that can respond to making sure that when we build again, we have a formula and a framework to have the funds to build. And I'll come back to that particular issue. Another development, Chairperson, which is key to the issue of funding, is the White Paper of 1998. White Paper of 1998, what were the key issues in 1998? The key issues in 1998 was competition and private sector participation in the electricity sector. The White Paper of 1998 was also responding to international developments in the electricity sector, where historically the electricity sector was organized in a vertically integrated way. That is, you have generation, transmission, and distribution in one company, vertical integration. In the late 90s, worldwide, there was a move, I think, led by Europe, in particular the UK, to say, break down the vertical chain, take out competitive elements in the electricity sector, and subject them to competition. Those elements which are natural monopolies, subject them to regulation, and make sure that customers are protected from the natural monopolies. So the idea of the 1998 White Paper was, you break up Eskom, you separate generation, you separate transmission, you take out distribution, you bring in, I think that's when the issue of the rates came in, you organize the distribution sector into regional electricity distribution entities, and you consolidate, in South Africa in particular, you consolidate Eskom and municipalities into these six entities to organize the distribution sector. Now, we need to say what happened with the aspiration of the white paper, bringing in private participation. I think judged against the objectives of bringing in private sector players, we should say the white paper of 1998 was not a spectacular success. Because as we look back and as we look today, there isn't any private participation in this industry of scale. And I think we should say we didn't succeed in attracting private sector players. But what is significant about this was that as a result of the intention to bring private sector in South Africa, there was a clear decision that says, Eskom, you cannot build and prepare to build the next capacity because you need to give space for private players to come in. That decision was only changed in 2004. By that time, I think it's history that we were on the back foot in terms of capacity, and also it is clear that financially we didn't prepare ourselves to this big build, and I'll talk a bit about that. So it's important to say, you know, what was the impact of the white paper of 1998 as it envisaged a competitive industry, private sector participation, and how have we done? I think some pieces of legislation that are key to the history is the fact that in 2001 we had the Eskom Conversion Act. That piece of legislation made it much more clear that Eskom is owned by the state. Prior to that, Eskom was operating under the Electricity Act, which was ambiguous in terms of its ownership and its shareholding. The Conversion Act made it more explicit, but also it also provided that Eskom should operate under the Companies Act, which brings it to any normal company with a clear shareholder under Companies Act expected to pay tax and dividends and like any other company. And that was a key legislation for 2001, the Conversion Act of Eskom. Of course, last year we had the electricity pricing policy, and the key aspect of the electricity pricing policy are the following, that the revenue for any entity in the industry should be based on full cost recovery that reflects the valuation of the electricity assets based on the replacement cost and market-related returns on the assets. That's a key part of the electricity pricing policy, beginning to say prices should reflect the economic cost of making electricity and should also reflect the returns required by any entity that operates in this industry. It also says non-discriminatory and transparent pricing with minimal cross subsidies, so remove any cross subsidies out of the industry, make it non-discriminatory, and the price must be transparent. And also the fact that we need to develop and publish a multi-year pricing path to give much more certainty to all the players in the industry. Now, Chairperson, just maybe a bit of reflection around the key themes that emerges out of the history of electricity since 1922 and the evolution thereof. There is a theme that reflects the period from 1922 to 1998. And that theme is public benefit paradigm. That is, electricity and the industry essentially exist to make sure that the economy and the country develops and grows. So it's based on the fact that electricity and electricity provision is purely for public benefit rather than for commercial gain. So you provide electricity cheaply, abundantly, you provide it wherever it's required, and the basis is industrialization, economic development, and the growth of the country. And you provide it neither for profit nor for loss. I think that's the key paradigm that drove electricity provision from 1922 to 1998. From 1998, I think we brought in a different paradigm. That paradigm is commercial and competition paradigm. There you begin to say electricity should be like any other commodity. It should attract a market-related return, and it should attract private sector investment in the industry. Now, what we should also say, as I've already indicated, the question we should ask is, have we succeeded in this change of paradigm of being able to attract competition, private sector participation in this industry as a result of the white paper of 1998? Judged against evidence today, I think it's clear that we have not been able to do so. And the biggest part of it is, I mean, I think this is the important thing that we need to understand. Attracting private sector players into the industry, there's a few things that you need to do. But the most important is that private players come in to make good returns for their shareholders. And for electricity, it means if you want to give good returns for your shareholders, the most important issue is price. So if an investor has to come into South Africa and invest in the electricity sector, they will judge the ability to derive maximum returns in South Africa compared to any other economy in the world. And the issue that is going to determine that largely is going to be price. If you're the lowest priced electricity in the world, you are not, therefore, a good attractor of private sector players. And that's the thing that I think we need to be able to acknowledge. So, where we are and where we need to go, those are the kind of choices we need to make. If we indeed want to go private sector, let's understand the implication. If we want to do something else, let's also understand the implication. So, Chairperson, what are the issues today? I think coming back to the issues of funding model, electricity pricing, and so forth. In my view, what we should be saying today is, and acknowledging today is, given the strategic nature of power provision, I think it's important to say, the provision of power in the economy and in the country is key to where the country needs to go. Therefore, its funding, its pricing, and how you organize it should be formulated to reflect the objectives of where the country is going. Because it's fundamental. In the absence of confidence about the provision of power, nothing happens in the economy. No other projects can come in the absence of a clear path of where the power is going to come from. So today the issues, the leadership issues that we need to deal with is we must formulate the direction we are taking in the context of where the country is going so that we can give clear confidence and a clear path going forward. The second issue which we need to acknowledge is that given the infrastructure that we require to build for the future, we've moved significantly, but we currently don't have a comprehensive integrated funding model that makes sure that we can provide the confidence that we'll be able to build infrastructure for the future. Hence the discussions we have had to make sure that we can deal with the funding model. I now link this to the discussion we've had about the interim with NASA. Recognizing this fact that we don't have an integrated funding model, we made a choice, and through a dialogue, we made a choice to say, before we put in a long-term pricing application, let's provide space to have this discussion and dialogue. Hence, we decided early this year to go for an interim application for a year so that by the time we put in a multi-year price determination, it's informed by an integrated funding model that responds to all the issues we have raised. We have now had the price the price determination by NERSA, as reflected by the document we have submitted. The interim application was based on the determination of NERSA of last year of 20 to 25%. We took the higher number, which was 25 plus inflation. We applied for 34%. NERSA made a determination of 31.3%, and that was based on a difference that we had. NERSA says, look, the inflation is not 9%, it's 6.3, and hence the 31.3 as opposed to 34%. And the other key element of that was that the environmental levy was introduced. That also took the effective price increase to somewhere between 23 and 24%. And this is where we are. So where are we going? We did indicate that by the end of the month, of this month of September, we should then have clear path around the funding model. And what is this funding model? And I think a lot of people have been, saying, what is this funding model? What does it mean? Chairperson, the funding model is not any complicated magic formula. The funding model is really about choices. Where does revenue required come from in terms of the electricity industry? There are four sources of funds in terms of electricity. The first one is tariffs. You derive revenue from tariffs, and that's determined by NERSA, and that's what you apply for. That's the first one. The second one, you can derive funding from reserves or retained earnings. That is funds you accumulated historically in anticipation for future investment. Most companies who are anticipating that they're going to go through a huge capital expansion, they will deliberately retain reserves to be able to respond to that. The fourth aspect is you ask for equity. Sorry, the third aspect indeed. The third aspect is you would ask for new equity, either as a private company you list, or you attract or talk to new shareholders. In our case, we've got one shareholder, which is the state, and we've had discussion with the state, and they've already done something in that regard. The last source, or the fourth source of funds, is borrowings. That is, you go to the debt market, capital market, and you raise money for new expansion. Now, let me just talk about each one of these options and where are we and what are the issues. Revenue is based on tariffs, and historically our tariffs have been very low. And when you look at the capital expansion against the tariffs, there's a big gap. And when you look back into the 70s, they had similar challenges. When they had to go through this massive expansion, the tariffs, the normal tariffs, were not adequate. And hence, their solution was a capital development fund. Increase the tariffs more than you require so that you can have reserves to respond to capital. Our current tariffs are very low in relation to the capital expansion that we're looking for. Now, let's look at retained earnings or reserves. Eskom didn't put up retained earnings or reserves, one, because the tariffs were low, two, because since 1998, when the decision was made, don't build. There was no rationale to go and ask for tariffs to build up reserves to build. I mean, so the financial preparation for this build was never happened because we were not going to build. So it seems no one prepared themselves to build. The anticipation was that the private sector will come in, but there are contradictions. If your price is low, it doesn't attract private sector. If Eskom is not building, it can't ask for more tariffs because it's not going to be building. So we don't have those reserves. Now, let's look at new equity. The only source has been government. Government has already come in with $60 billion, which is largely It's a loan, but it's a deeply subordinated loan. It's almost equal to equity. And I mean, clearly they've indicated that that's it in terms of their ability to bring equity. But also what they also did was to give us guarantees of 177 billion to allow us to borrow more. Let's look at borrowings. What are the issues in terms of borrowings? Borrowings, there is a defined limit that you can borrow. It depends on, I mean, any borrower, any bank that borrows money will look at your ability to pay it back. And your ability to pay it back will depend on your revenue. Your revenue depends on your tariff. So if your tariffs are low, your capability to borrow is also low, because that reflects your ability to repay the debt. So, Chairperson, all of these issues are related. And the issue about the funding model is nothing less than us making a choice about all of the things that we've talked about. The issue is, what is the tariff that we need to bring in to make sure that we can be able not only to fund current operations, but to be able to deal with the future of the country. And this is the discussion that we are currently undertaking, and we're hoping by the end of this month we'll give direction. And that direction will then determine what tariffs are we applying for, and how much can we borrow, and can we continue on the build path that we are on. What is emerging, Chairperson, is that clearly everybody is saying the build program that ESCOM is on is important and it must continue. It is important because it provides for security of supply for the future. It makes sure that we have enough power to power the economic aspiration of this country. So it must continue. The second point about the build program, that in these economic times, when the global economic growth is down, having a build program of this nature provides an economic stimulus, and it's important that it continues for that reason. And in fact, it's the biggest build program in this country, so it's the biggest contributor to us being able to go through this economic dip that is determined by the crisis. So that is the first consensus. The second consensus is to say we should make sure that the industry is sustainable. You cannot live from hand to mouth. You need to make sure that the industry is sustainable. It's an important industry. Hence, we should find an integrated, sustainable funding model that ensures that. So what we expect is that we need then to say, what are the solutions that keeps these objectives of keeping the build and keeping a sustainable industry. But also we need to be saying that in the absence of us solving all of the funding requirements, the consequences could be some projects may be slowed down, because any enterprise has to live within its own means. If a funding gap, what it means, you will adjust your operations and your build to live within the means available. That could have consequences in terms of power supply for the future, but those are the balancing issues that we need to deal with. And as I've said, these are not formula-based issues. These are leadership choices, and each one of them has difficult consequences, and we need to be able to make the choices. Let me just conclude by a few other key strategic issues that must be considered as we move forward. The first one, clearly, the issue about whatever tariff increases that you bring in, one must be circumspect about their impact on the economy. I think you want to keep the build, you must increase tariffs, but you must be responsible in the way you increase them so that you don't damage the growth of the economy. And that's an important issue. The other issue is uplifting of the poor. In the tariff increases, in all the things that we do, we should make sure that our objective as a country to uplift the poor is not compromised. If electricity goes up and it impacts on the poor, I think it is not a desirable outcome. So we need to make sure that whatever we do, we continue on the path of uplifting the poor. On our side as ESCOM, one of the issues that have been discussed is the issue of the cost of coal, the cost of primary energy, efficiencies around the procurement of coal, making sure that we've got enough coal in our operations, but also enough coal for the future is key. Coal is an important aspect of electricity production. It's the biggest cost item on our income statement. Now, managing that cost continues to be key as we move forward into the future. And, of course, we acknowledge that over the past few months, there have been question marks around the procurement and the cost of electricity, of coal, which we have addressed and addressing, and as we go into the future, we'll continue to address. This aspect is also impacted by the fact that when you have a very thin reserve margin, it puts pressure across your total value chain, and coal is also part of that. So dealing with that is important. Next issue is the issue of bringing coal to our power stations. As we use short-term contracted coal, we're exposed to transportation of coal. And if you've been to Mpumalanga, you could see some of the Mpumalanga roads are impacted by huge volumes of trucks delivering coal to our power stations. So dealing with road infrastructure, road maintenance is important as part of security of supply going forward, and we are in deep discussion with both the national government and the government, the provincial government of Mpumalanga, to deal with this issue to make sure that we can eliminate the risk associated with road transportation. The other big issue, Chairperson, which this country has to deal with and is an emerging global agenda, is the issue of climate change, CO2 emissions. Being one of the biggest users of coal, this has huge implications for us. It is clear that we need to begin to move to a path that is less carbon emitting. What it means is we need to start diversifying our primary energy mix. We need to be looking at renewables, nuclear, hydro, energy efficiencies to begin to lower our carbon footprint. And as a country, this is a big strategic issue, given the fact that our dependence on coal is huge. And I think we need to deal with this. Demand-side management, there is a huge opportunity in terms of reducing our usage, hence reducing our cost, and also impacting on the CO2 emissions if we can be more aggressive on demand-side management. There is a huge opportunity. We've gone some way, but in my view, there's still a big opportunity to really grab demand-side management, because that also can impact on the cost and all the issues that we need to deal with. Renewables is something that we should also aggressively move ahead. Solar is a big opportunity in South Africa, and our ability to take advantage of this is still very low compared to the opportunity. And we have seen that NERSA is taking up this issue to look at a regulatory mechanism and regulatory tariffing mechanism to be able to bring in more renewables in South Africa. Nuclear, as you know, end of last year, we sort of postponed our nuclear program, but to respond to climate change and to begin to diversify our mix, we need to be clear about the nuclear future, because from a baseload power station point of view, nuclear is an attractive option if we want to move aggressively to non-emitting technologies, and the country giving clear direction on nuclear is key. We have got a huge program around, in fact, a huge aspiration around IPPs. We've been talking about IPPs for some time, IPPs in South Africa. The introduction of IPPs, in my view, is important. Why is it important? it is clear that when you look at the size of this industry, there is huge opportunities to bring other people into the industry. For Eskom, what is important is that we take a position that we can't do it all and we don't know it all. So if during this build we are able to bring a framework that bring other people into the industry, it can assist the country. IPPs can bring in new sources of capital, new sources of skills, new sources of suppliers. It could also begin to broaden the discussion in South Africa. If you are a lone voice as an industry, the propensity for you to be believed is low. Let's just accept it. If there are other players who can say the same things or challenge the things that you say, there's a bigger debate, and I think the industry voice could become much more credible, much more diverse, and also bringing also an international flavor into it. So I think it's also in our interest to make sure that IPPs come in. But we should acknowledge that bringing in IPPs we need to resolve the issue of a market-related tariff, because otherwise IPPs are not going to be excited. The other element is IPPs in the region. There are IPPs in South Africa, but the IPPs in the region. They are potential sources of generation in the region, in particular hydro, which we do not have. Mozambique has got lots of hydro, and they also have gas. How do we organize or put a framework to be able to unlock this so that we can also uplift the region but address the security of supply for the region? Some of the benefits of a big build, which we see for South Africa, we also see for the region. And if we want to be a regional player in contributing to regional development, we should actually be able to put a framework to make sure that the regional projects also are dealt with. Lastly, Chairperson, the issues of the industry and the fact that this industry is key to where the country is going requires a deep collaborative approach to this discussion. It's not purely technical. It's about where the country is going. So being able to create a platform where we continue to talk about these issues and make the right choices is important. And we hope that by the end of this month we'll have clarity on the funding model and we can begin to move aggressively in addressing the issues of the industry. Chairperson, I'll stop there and invite some questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Maroga. No electricity, unfortunately, is the main source of energy that most South Africans use, and most South Africans are poor people that put the government where it is today. And affordability is a key issue that needs to be looked at. But I hope with what we hear about the losses from Eskom is not going to affect the poor people. Poor people are not going to pay the losses that have been incurred by Eskom. But I'll give to members. I've got one apology from Mr. Lucas from the IFT, and maybe other members are still coming. I'll give over to members to table questions if they have to, or clarities on the submission that was given by Mr. Maroga. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think everybody in the country currently is very worried about the already high rises in tariffs that we have and also the possible future tariffs that we also heard from Mr. Maroga that is going to come at the end of September, or the application. But it is also important that Eskom deliver electricity to the nation as cheaply and as efficiently as they can. I hear all the stories about the build and so on, but I'm really worried about the cost effectiveness of Eskom, and I would like him to talk a little bit on that. What Eskom is doing to also save money, what Eskom is doing especially on the short-term coal contracts and so on. And after that answer, I'll most probably have a few more questions. Thank you, ma'am.
Any more questions?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Mine will also be on the issue of the rate maintenance and the road transport. I want really to hear from Eskom. Is the road transport the only way where they can transport the coal from one point to the other point in the Mpumalanga province? And if there is talks on this now, how far is it off on the issue of rail transport of your coal? And actually, what is the cheapest one of to transport your coal from one corner to the other corner to save cost of more cost effective? If you said you have so many losses in your organization, and also on the issue of the roads, is it not more money the government was spent on road maintenance? If you are, or what is the contribution today? Is that the one you're saying in your presentation about 500 million that you bring to the table on road maintenance? I just thinking, Chairperson, we're going next year to 2010 World Cup, and if Eskom is making so use of this road transport, will it not actually affect our transport system for next year, for the 2010 World Cup? That's my one point, because I think we must really bring Transnet to a point where he's saying that he must do something about the railway line if they were not upgrading it for the last few years. The other point is, Chairperson, on the point that the gentleman was saying in his presentation that they really look on the issue of the poor of the poor. I think that is an important point. And my question will be, will this increase of now affecting our people, or will you cater our poor people for the next increase? And if NERSA was directed you to giving 50% to home light 1 and 2 tariffs, on the tariffs, my question will be for the municipality to find the bulk service from you on the point of the electricity. I know there are some municipalities who have their own electricity generators, but most of the municipality is buying their bulk electricity from Eskom. Now, my question will be, how will Eskom monitor this thing that the municipalities really will not let our people pay more than the limit price on the increase of the electricity? Because, you know, of the most of our poor people is making use of that basic service. That's the one I want to ask you.
Thank you, Chair. Morning, member. That tomorrow, okay, in that. And I'm not happy. The poor people are suffering down there. My belief is that you grow up in the rural area yourself, and if you grow up in the rural area, you'll understand how price increases affect poor people. Very much important that irrespective whether you went upscaling, you know, upgraded yourself to a certain level, but you should never forget where you come from. My charity will seek to address the issue of irrespective that so many or large amounts of money has been lost. Have you ever sat down and planned a recovery plan in terms of how do you ensure that you recover all the loss? Have you ever made checking, balance check, what made you to have this loss? Have you ever made the research to say what makes Eskom pays more to these trucks in delivering the coal? Because the information that I have is that, especially in Mpumalanga, I'm from Mpumalanga, so I'll speak about something that I know. Mpumalanga is one of the areas that produces more coal. And the information that I have is that some of the coal, especially that one that is supplying Majuba, is coming from the side of KZN. You must be able to tell me what is the reason for that. And I hear you saying there are four sources, funding models. But myself, I want to add one. Well, the last, you said the sources that are funding modeling are the tariffs, the reserves, which are your investments, and the new equity, the shareholders themselves, and also the province. But you forgot to say even your bonuses can contribute. What do you think of that? Don't you think we should just to supplant, just forget about bonuses, just one. Don't you think it would work? I'm just posing a question to you. But in an actual sense, one of the reports that I have here from Salga, it tells that Eskom is in tatters. The reason that there is this problem is because of poor planning and failure in doing adequate research and adequate planning and specification. What is your view in terms of that? Thank you.
Honorable Member Slow.
Thank you, Chairperson. Dr. Maroha, we must thank you for this elaborate presentation you made. Very much clear. You made it as simple as possible. But Chairperson, I must start by apologizing for coming late. I was looking around for the venue of the meeting and went to the wrong place. Because you see, unfortunately, I'm now in the new wing, and when you say V to me, it means Dr. Maroha, you spoke about the integrated funding model. And the most mind-boggling question is the question you posed to us and to the country as a whole to say, where is this country going? The importance of electricity and options through which we can be able to raise funds or revenue, if we want to call it. Strategic issues that you are looking at in the process of developing this particular model of pricing, such as competition, the impact on the poor, uplifting, and so on and so on. You mentioned them. I don't have to repeat them. But you said one thing that left me with a question mark. to say you would be able to give direction by the end of the month. But, you know, it's so hidden. If you could give us some kinds of signs as to this direction, where you are actually looking at, because the presentation is broad and does not give us some kind of direction.
Over to you, Mr. Maroka.
Chairperson, thanks for those questions. I'll attempt to answer them sequentially, but some of them I'll group because they are related. I think the first one, let me maybe deal with one issue which is, I think has come through, which is the losses that we have reported. Chairperson, as this was not really the presentation of the annual report, we will be presenting our annual report next week at the portfolio of public enterprises, and we can deal with this thing extensively. But let me just deal with this particular issue of the loss, because that's an important issue that sets the context. We have reported and what you call an operating income loss at ESCOM, and we announced it at our annual results. This loss, the operating income loss, was anticipated. Why was it anticipated? Last year, when we requested for price increases and we got a determination by NERSA, we assessed what ESCOM required to keep the lights on against what was provided. And that assessment says if we have to do what's required to keep the lights on, we'll end up with an operating income loss. And ESCOM made a decision that we will do what's required to keep the lights on. So what happened? We had an operating income loss. It's within and lower than what was anticipated, but it was in the context of making sure that we keep the lights on. Clearly, you can't do that forever. You can't, you know, an operating income loss is not, you can't sustain that. End of this financial year, our plan is to break even or make a positive profit. And that's our intention. So the loss was based on that determination. But let me also add something which is also compounding the loss. I think we have seen a figure of 9.7 billion, and we've had some exotic description of thing called embedded derivatives. And without attempting to go through an accounting explanation, let me just share with the committee what it is and so that it's understood. The embedded derivative loss is an accounting treatment of long-term commodity-linked contracts. It is a paper loss. It is not real cash that is left to till. It's an accounting treatment. And it's dictated by modern accounting standards. And those standards seek more transparency. If you've got a long-term contract and it's based on some linkage of commodities, modern accounting standards prescribe that you should value that contract and its impact you must bring into the income statement. Auditors and analysts discount embedded derivatives because they understand what it is. Previous years, we used to make it was positive. We used to see a bigger profit than the actual profit because of embedded derivatives. We reported it, but that was not money in the till. It is paper money. And it's not, I mean, it's not important. It's important, and especially now, you have seen in the past few years where companies who hide certain risks within their financial statements may impact investors because investors don't see beyond the income statement. So hence, the accounting authorities are saying, make it more transparent. So that's hence this embedded derivative loss. And it's based on largely aluminium contracts, which we entered into in the past few years when we responded to the excess capacity. And when it got excess capacity, aluminium contracts are attractive because they're huge consumers of electricity. But to attract them, you have to link their price to the aluminium price. So I hope that is sufficient. So from a financial standpoint, I mean, we get our statement audited, and our auditors are happy and clear about our financial health. And despite the fact that we're making an operating income loss, our financials have been cleared by our auditors. And I think the issue is, as we move forward, we need to be able to deal with the funding model so that we continue to be on a sound financial footing. So that's, I think, it's important that I dealt with that. Chairperson, I think the issue of the effectiveness as Eskom is an important critical issue. And I think it's an important critical issue for a number of reasons. One, as we seek these high tariffs, clearly, you know, I think the public should have the comfort that the tariffs are not paying for inefficiencies. They are paying for the real thing, which is the build and sustaining this industry for the future of this country. So we take that seriously. And secondly, I think the fact that we are virtually a monopoly in generation, it is equally much more important that efficiencies are clear and we can demonstrate our efficiencies. The issue of primary energy in particular, which is the issue of coal, and let me just deal with it because it comes in terms of efficiency. Historically, we buy coal on long term. That is, every power station will have a tight contract and will have a mine close to that power station that supplies the mine, the power station, for the life of the power station. Now, the power station's average life could be between 40 and 60 years. So we will build a power station on a coal resource which can last us between 40 and 60 years. And on that basis, we get a very competitive price of coal. When you look at internationally and look at the price that Eskom is paying for coal compared to other international companies, by far the lowest. It's based on this model of coal close to the power station, long-term contract. What has changed? What are the things that have changed that has increased the price of coal? Because we're not allowed to build, the reserve margin, which is the spare capacity in the system, begin to decline. When that happens, the power stations that we have, you run them harder. Now, some of the power stations, as you run them harder, that is, some of them, average, we'll be running them at about 75% capacity, and we'd plan the mine at 75% capacity. Now, because you need more capacity, you run the stations to, say, 90%. Now, if you run the station to, say, 90%, the issue is, can the mine also provide coal to run at that level? Some mines can and some mines can't. Where the mines can't, we augment what's required with what is called short-term contracted coal. Because you need the capacity of the station, but the mine cannot supply sufficient coal, you go and buy short-term contracted coal. Now, short-term contracted coal, 5 to 10 years, as opposed to 40 to 60 years. Why is then the short-term contracted coal more expensive? Which is important. The underlying cost, if it's a short-term, because in a short-term mine, you want to recoup all of the cost in a shorter period. So the price is going to be higher than if you're looking at a 40 to 60 years. That's the first thing. The underlying cost of coal is much higher. The second aspect is that short-term contracted coal you must transport through road transport, mostly. The transportation cost could actually be almost half the price of short-term contracted coal. So as the reserve margin continues to be squeezed and we run this power station much harder, we expose ourselves to short-term contracted coal, hence the huge increase. And by and large, that is the major increase in the cost of coal. And yes, even with that explanation, obviously we look at efficiencies in how we procure coal because it's a big cost. And this year, you know, that is going to going to come about. Maybe this also added in another issue, which is the context for last year. Because of the issues we had to deal with in coal last year, that is, we had a shortage of coal. I mean, we had about 10 days of stock. Where else our aspiration is to be above 20 days of stock. We had to go through an emergency purchase of coal. Emergency purchase means the price you prepare to pay is higher than normal because you are in an emergency. So that also brought came into our cost of coal. And that's the most important aspect of coal in terms of efficiency. Now, let me just talk about efficiencies in general. I mean, we do benchmarks of our cost across the world, and by and large, you know, there is always evidence that says the price of electricity that we sell it at compared to international, we still, as a country, number one. It doesn't mean there are not areas of improvements, but we're still at the top of that list. We do benchmarks in terms of how we do maintenance, and by and large, in terms of how we run large coal-based power stations, by and large, everyone confirms that we are on top of our game. The issues that have emerged in terms of load shedding and the shortage largely have to do with the fact that we don't have enough capacity in the system. That's the major part. It's less to do with whether we're running the power system efficiently, more to do with you don't have enough capacity in the system. And the issue is, how do we run a very tight system until we have enough power stations in the system that gives enough reserve margin? We run a very tight system. And it's that tightness that is putting risk to the supply of electricity. So I think that is important to give that particular context. Road transportation, is it the only way? As long as we expose to short-term contracted coal, most of it is going to be on road. There are some areas where a rail solution is being looked at. And I'll tell you the reason why we're going to be exposed to road transportation. The stations which we are running higher than what was planned, we anticipate that once the system has enough capacity, we'll run those stations at the levels that they're designed for so that the mine can match the requirement of the power station. So it's not going to be cost-effective to build a long-term rail solution to solve a short-term problem. So we don't want to, because this problem is temporary. Once we build the power stations, we should return to the right reserve margins. Then the power station run as they are required. Now, you've asked about Majuba. Majuba is a station where we need a long-term rail solution. Why? Because we don't have a dedicated mine at Majuba. When we built Majuba, we were aiming to have a dedicated mine. But during the development of the mine, geological faults were found in developing the mine. So the mine plans were abandoned. So we built a power station, no mine. And all the requirements of that power station is based on short-term coal. Half of it comes from rail. We want 100% of it to come from rail. There we are looking at a Majuba rail link where we can have all of Majuba's requirements based on rail. And it does two things. It lowers the cost and it gives us security of supply of the coal. And that's what we're aiming for. Of course, yes, I think we're also worried about the impact of coal transportation on general road users and the state of the roads. And you're right, you know, we need to watch this space in terms of how it impacts on 2010. I mean, clearly it's restricted to Mpumalanga, so we need to have a focused solution. Indeed, you're correct. It's a very serious situation. And in trying to find the solution for the roads, I mean, you know, it has been a very difficult issue because the competency of who deals with the road is also, you know, is it national, is it provincial, or is it because it's ESCOM, because they are causing the damage? There's been, you know, diverse opinions about how we deal with the issue of the roads. But, you know, as I said, we are in intense discussion with the Mpumalanga government, and we remain confident that we will find a lasting solution. The impact on the poor, or the uplifting of the poor, because I think the issue is we should be more focusing on how do we make sure that we uplift the poor. That is, the industry should have an intention to contribute to the uplifting of the poor rather than just protecting the poor. We want to make sure that people move out of poverty, that whatever we do. And when we look at the BUILD program, its macroeconomic impact, jobs, skills, education should also be a contributor to the country issues, unemployment and poverty. However, in specific terms, in terms of price increases, you've seen in the application of NERSA has determined on, we are limiting the increases to people who were designated as poor to less than what everybody gets, which is about 15%. That's the first issue. The second issue is what has been considered and been talked about is about, can we increase the free basic electricity allocation from the current 50 kilowatt hours to something else? Now, that increase obviously must be paid for. The question is it at a national level or within the industry? And that's part of what has been discussed. The other issue that you raised, which is key, is that given the fact that these customers are not only ESCOM customers, they're municipal customers, and they're different systems and tariffing, how do we make sure that we're consistent? That, I think, still remains a big issue. And I think it reflects this issue about the state of the distribution industry, where there's still fragmentation, different systems, different tariffs, and different standards. And to an extent that we solve that problem, we can be able to solve this issue about dealing with uplifting the poor in a consistent way. And that's going to be the integration of that. I think I may have dealt with the issue of the recovery plan of how we deal with the loss. And as I've indicated, the operating loss was anticipated based on the fact that we clearly knew that the bottom line of the country in terms of keeping the lights on was a major consideration in planning for an operating loss. Because we understood, and we still understand, that if power is not available, the impact on the bottom line of the economy is massive. And we made decisions accordingly. However, as I've indicated, going forward, we need to make sure that we have a sustainable industry which is fully funded and the tariffs reflect the underlying cost of the industry. And that's the path we are on. I think the issue about the Majuba, I've dealt with. We're hoping that we will have a permanent solution for Majuba Power Station in terms of a rail link, because Majuba doesn't have a dedicated mine. It requires a long-term solution in terms of transportation. The issue of whether bonuses can be part of the funding model is a very innovative one. And Chairperson, I think if you go and look at the annual results and look at the bonuses versus the funding gap, you'll see that we need many years of bonuses to be able to deal with that. But I think probably the member is talking about really a show of contribution. And all I can say is that I take the point. The issue that you raised about poor planning, and you said that Salga is of the view that what we've gone through is because of poor planning on the side of Eskom. I've indicated that I think where we are as an industry is a reflection of decisions as a country we made about the industry. So some of the policy choices we took didn't give the desired outcomes. And we need to acknowledge that without trying to blame anybody. We need to acknowledge made choices, they didn't give the desired outcome. And what we need to do is to review and then go on a different path and learn from the choices we have made. And let me also say that in terms of these choices, I mean, we should also review the state of other economies which we were using as benchmarks. There was a recent article in The Economist talking about the state of the power system in the UK. The UK has been the model that we used in the 1990s as an example of how you deregulate an industry. In that article, they quote that the UK in the next few years could be where South Africa was from 2007, given the fact that through privatization and private sector involvement, the issue of security of supply has not received attention. Because it is not necessarily the desire of a private player to respond to security of supply. Private players respond to profit, they respond to returns. And whether there's shortage or no shortage, a private player can make money. However, when you respond to security of supply, you require an integrated national plan to be able to intervene and make sure that plans are made to secure electricity for the future. So we need to review as a country where we are in comparison to those we saw as leaders and say, are we still on the right path to make sure that we can deal with the unique issues of the country and make the right policy choices so that, and again, what is important also is also to acknowledge that the lead time for the consequences of decision in these industries are long. You can make a decision that looks good today. 10 years could be the most disastrous decision. So long-term planning and planning to make sure that you can anticipate not only in 5 years, but in 25 years, you can anticipate what you need to do now to respond to those issues is key. So I think what is important is to say, are we on the right, can we learn from where we come from? Are we on the right path? Have we learned from other people? Can we hardwire integrate those lessons in our view of the future? The last point was the direction on the funding model. There is a task team which constitute a number of departments of the government, including ESCOM, to look at options of the funding model, which will then give the first view of how the funding model should look like. But between now and when NERSA make a determination, obviously there's going to be more public participation to say these are the choices that the country needs to make. And hopefully the first of that view will emerge by the end of this month. And that will begin to integrate or bring other views so that by the time we emerge with a decision,
by NERSA, which we anticipate should be early next year, the views of most stakeholders will be incorporated in that process. Thanks, sir.
Mr. Motel.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start, Chair, by thanking Mr. Maroha for being here. It's vitally important for us to hear it, so to speak, from the horse's mouth. And whilst we're talking about that, just a comment first before I ask a question. The whole issue of the accounting loss, the derivatives thing, I think the problem for us is that in the public mind, it gives an impression that management is either reckless or careless or not prudent enough. And that's really the problem that we have here. So we need to always look at those kinds of things and think about them. If you look into the document that you provided us kindly yesterday, the ESCOM application for an interim price increase, and you look at page 6, 7 of 27, at the bottom of the page, 322, there's a very good summation of the real issue, the challenges that I must say you so crisply outlined for us. And reading through that part of it, where we're looking at the funding model, the options, the things that really are there, the tariffs, reserves, those things that whether we've got to borrow, whether we've got to do this or the other thing. I think really the challenge here is this. How do we move? How do we transit from this current dispensation where ESCOM has to go to NERSA for a whopping increase and ESCOM having money to be able to continue the build program? I think that's the challenge. As the task team looks at this, they've got to find out what's the bridge. And the bridge, indeed, from your own expose, Mr. Maroha, is clearly you cannot hurt the poor, but you've got to fund the building program. How do you do it without doing the other thing? The other point that I want to raise, if we had more time, I would say let's take those issues point by point, but in your application, the previous one, Salga raised a number of questions there, and they're all pertinent as far as I'm concerned. Sort of a global question, have you responded to Salga satisfactorily on all those questions? I don't want us to take them one by one, otherwise we'll be here the whole day. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Member. Honorable Khade.
Thanks, Chair. I have a follow-up question. in relation to your emergency coal purchasing, I didn't get a clarity in terms of what is happening with these long-term contracts that you have. And I want to get a clarity that these short-term contracts that you have, where do you get this coal? You get it out of this province or out of the surrounding vicinities, get it somewhere far away or not? Because I'm saying this because the some of the response that I've or report that I've received from the constituencies is that ESCOM pays more tariffs or pays more when the truck drives more kilometers. So therefore, they come with these short-term contracts to, instead of them going to Worldwide Coal in Carolina to get coal, they drive to Newcastle to get coal, of which, you know, when you can, excuse me, when you look at this distance, ESCOM also suffers that loss. That's one of the issues that I want to check in terms of what exactly. But the last issue is that in terms of your long-term contract, what entails, because I need to get a clarity in terms of your aluminum procurement issue in relation to the BHP Billiton and the other company. Because my view is that there's sort of a limitation in terms of who supplies you with what.
I think that's one of the other issues, because there's no competition in terms of the supplement of ESCOM. There's a limit in terms of whether is this one going to offer this one, then you take it, or your procurement process is also outlined it clearly to say you go up to this limit. If these companies, they go up to that limit, you re-advertise or all those kind of things. You need to get a clarity in terms of that. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Say you said that ESCOM decided to do whatever is required to keep the lights on. And for sure, all of us are very grateful for keeping the lights on after the big disaster of 88. But you still haven't answered my question that I originally asked. So perhaps I'll give you a few examples and then you can react on that. Just one or two other comments. You said that the cost of production of electricity in South Africa is very cheap against the rest of the world. For sure it is so. But also remember that we have a national asset that is called coal. That's also the cheapest in the world. And I think it's totally unfair for you to compare our prices with the rest of the world. That's one advantage that we have, that we can provide cheap electricity if done effectively. I just want to go back to VHT Bulletin that the gentleman also, or my honorable colleague also mentioned. It is very interesting, sir, that you say it's a book loss. But remember, it's something that you delivered to them. You delivered electricity to them. And for that, you didn't get the money that you should have got. It's interesting, sir, that all smelters in South Africa have cut down on production, except Billiton. They actually upped their production during the time because they're getting the cheap electricity from you. There's a few things that I would just like to talk about to explain to you that I think that ESCOM itself is not run cost-effectively. Let's go to the build-up of reserves. First of all, you know, and it's international standard, that the reserve for coal is 20 days. Yesterday we had NERSA here. They also acknowledged that they actually gave you 20 days, and that was what they allow you to keep. In your annual report, you actually say that the reserves have been built up to 41 days. Now, a very simple calculation, sir, will tell you that this is about, if I work on 200 rand a ton for coal, and you know you pay more on a short-term contract, you come to about 1.906 billion, almost 2 billion, that was paid additional for coal, that is shown, therefore, as something you've bought, but nowhere in your financial statements it's shown as a plus or something that you have. Another thing that we need to look at is, and you talked at the BOLT program, where there was no plans from BOLT program. So this is not something that is new. I think in 2003 the decision was changed by the cabinet. But from 2000 up till now, you've paid out about 13 billion in dividends to the government. Another interesting one, and if I'm correct, you need about 340 billion for your BOLT program. The government has already borrowed 60 billion to you. And once again, if you go to your own statements, an amount of 286 billion rand is outstanding debtors to you. 286, you can look at your own statements, sir. That's money that is owed to you. Why don't you just collect it? And then you've got enough money to do your whole BOLT program. You've talked about nuclear, where you've actually decided you can't go on with nuclear because it's too expensive. Once again, according to your statement or your annual report, the cost to build nuclear is about $550,000 per kilowatt. Where you got that figures must be wonderful. I just went on the internet and I went to Australia sites, I went to France sites, I went to American sites and so on. The most expensive I could get was something about $4,000 per kilowatt. And I've got the documents here if you don't believe me. Let's go back to Arriva. Last year, Arriva openly stated that 85% of the offer they made to you is already funded. You decided you can't do that because you haven't got the money. Now let's go a little bit about your own internal documents, sir, and I want to go to coal. In the last 2 years, at Arno Power Station, you lost 80,000 tons of coal. At Kriel, 278,000 tons of coal. If you don't believe me, it's in an internal document that was actually addressed to you, sir. At Majuba, 400,000 tons of coal was lost. Our problem with coal is, especially on the short-term contracts, it makes up about 25% of the volume, but about 50% of the cost. And I don't believe that these things are run effectively. If you look, you must perhaps tell us also about the claim of $70 million from BTH Billiton for overpayment. You must know about it because, once again, it's in your own internal documents. Let's talk a little bit about the procurement of Medupi Power Station. You started at $26 billion. The minister on national TV already acknowledged that it is $80 billion, and you know the real figure will be $120 billion. I once again want to read to you from an internal document where you actually stated, it was once again a document from Eskom, where they say the right procurement policies has not been followed, and that there were serious problems with the procurement activities in Medupi. That's also your internal thing. If you look at the collieries, and I'm talking about, once again, from a document that was dated June last year, collieries are currently delivering between 20 to 50% below their burn rates. And we have not formally instructed the major houses to increase coal production sections so as to alleviate the shortage of coal over the next 10 years. But you want to build 40 mines in the Waterberg. Once again, from your own internal documents, by just moving coal between the different stockpiles, the cost is an additional cost of about 60 to 150 million rand per month. I want to read to you where you say coal that was offered to you. We're talking about optimum colliery at Andrina Power Station. They sure delivered by an excess, a factor in excess of 3 million tons over the past 3 years. But you were offered optimum coal at a price which I believe is nearly 40 to 50% higher than the contract price that Eskom would be paying the mine for coal for direct purposes. So this is the problems that is happening. Your own mines and the people that are supplying is under-delivering, but in the meantime, it is bought in other contracts and especially during the short-term contracts. Majuba Mine, sir, you talked, and this is something perhaps you can explain to us. At Majuba, you had this colliery. This colliery is currently covered with cement, if I'm correct, because of the open mine that couldn't go on. And you remember all these shafts of hard rock that was found. And what I can't understand is the coal is still there. You know the coal is there. Why don't you just go down and have a shaft mine there? Now we're having all these excess costs to bring in the coal from different parts. Once again, from your internal documents, most of the mines consist of at least 50% mud and stone, and most have excessive dust. This is the problem that we have with buy-ins. Now, we could talk about this for hours, sir. What I'm trying to say is, why must NERSA or whoever pay to Eskom a further increase if I've just shown you here of Eskom is not running as cost-effective as it can? Eskom is wasting money. They're not doing what they're supposed to do according to the department's instructions, even on their own documents. You state cost-effective electricity. But here I've given you a lot of examples of where things are going wrong at Eskom. Madam Chair, I think if we can have a few answers on this, perhaps a few more questions later.
Yes, I'm sure you're working for your wages. Chairperson, I don't. I think, Chairperson, for the last few years, the most of the people in this country, and also here in Parliament, talking about the scale skills. I see on the presentation is that ESCOM talking about the human capital, and I also see that most of the scale skill workers are leaving ESCOM all South Africa. So I want to know, why are those people are leaving? Are they looking for greener pastures or whatever? Because we must try to retain those people in our country. We can't afford to losing it. Especially with the challenge of the climate change. And I think that's the thing that really need attention from ESCOM. The other thing is, yesterday, that's a comment on the point of the skills. Yesterday in the presentation of NERSA, I think one of our colleagues was asking the question, why did ESCOM build in schools? This is not a function. But in my mind, back of my mind, I was thinking, I think this is part of your social responsibility to doing that. On the point of the view that we must try to motivate kids to learning the new technology and also those things that we can look maybe for the future, what type of energy can we create in our country and not only rely on other, maybe on coal and those things. That way maybe you maybe invest to build schools. Thank you.
Mr. Moroha, you mentioned that you are presenting next week to the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises. Well, I think you answered it. But I think this committee, like the questions that Mr. Schmidt raised, are not from your presentation, but they are general questions that he got from internet. But I think it's important for this committee maybe to be invited to public enterprises so that most of the questions and advices and that we have, we can also share in that committee. But maybe the chairperson can speak to the other chairperson and try to make that happen. But you are at liberty to answer all the questions if you want to.
Chairperson, I think let me start with Mr. Smith's questions. Let me say, Mr. Smith's questions, I think, shows interest by this committee on the things that we do. And the detailed questions that he is asking, I think, prompts me to say, Chairperson, I think in your schedule of activities, there is elements of site tools. And given the interest that this committee is showing on this particular subject, I want to publicly invite you to ESCOM, to our particularly our coal procurement entity, and we will have more quality time to engage on these questions because they are extensive questions. And I understand, appreciate that the issue of particularly coal as a big cost item on our income statement attracts a lot of focus. And I think equally, we need to make sure that we answer it comprehensively. So, as they say, seeing is believing. I want to invite the committee because some of the questions I think will take some time to answer comprehensively, and I don't want to skimp the answers. But to invite the committee and at an appropriate time to have a specific visit on this issue where we can give comprehensive answers. Chairperson, I think there was questions about the accounting loss and in particular the issue of the embedded derivatives. Maybe let me just also delve again into it so that it is understood in its fuller context. The aluminium contracts were entered into when we had excess capacity. After 1984, we had this huge excess capacity, which we built between the 70s and the 80s. In that time, the country anticipated a high economic growth. It didn't happen, but we had this huge capacity. We have had this huge excess capacity, you can imagine, from 1984 to, in fact, it could be up to 2007, because that's when we started having new capacity coming into into stream. So for over 20 years, we built so much in the 80s that we didn't have to build any capacity. Now, to utilize that excess capacity, high electricity intensive smelters were seen as a candidate that we can attract to utilize this excess capacity. To do so, if you want aluminium smelters to come in, to do so, the practice of the time was that to attract an aluminium smelter, you price the electricity to aluminium. You link the price of electricity to aluminium. Why do you do so? You hedge the risk of aluminium to the movement of the price of aluminium. And that's the standard way of doing it. Now, what it means is that when the price of aluminium goes up, your revenue goes up from those customers. When the price of electricity goes down, or the price of aluminium goes down, the revenue from those customers goes down. So you are exposed to the price of aluminium. That's the first thing. But the second thing that we do is that we also hedge the revenue from this contract. That is, we fix the revenue by paying people to hedge this thing for us. So that even if the price of aluminium goes up and down, our revenue is protected. So whatever the price of aluminium, we hedge the revenue. So we are not fully exposed to the volatility of aluminium. However, the accounting treatment is irrespective of whether you hedge or you don't hedge. That is, how you treat this from an accounting point of view got nothing to do with what you actually receive. And this is, and I'm going to be slightly technical, but it's important. In valuating the embedded derivatives, you say, you know, some of the contracts still have 15 to 20 years to go. So the accounting treatment, you valuate the contract for the next 15 to 20 years and say, how much is it worth? And in particular, you compare, if it was on standard tariff, how much should it have been? If it's linked to aluminium, how much is it and what is the gap? Now, if it's a positive gap, it impacts positively on your income statement, but it's paper money, or negatively. So the 9.7 billion, the 9.7 billion is an evaluation of the 15 to 20 years remaining life of the contract. It's not money in or money out of the till. And we can spend more time in explaining that fact because it's clearly articulated in how these things are accounted for. There is an issue about whether we've dealt with the Sauger concerns satisfactorily. We've been engaging with Sauger and on the issues that they've raised. Some of them have to do with timing of the application. There are statutory requirements which we must comply with, and we're making sure that this time we comply to those, and in collaboration with them, we'll make sure that we deal with the substantive issues that they have raised. On the issue of emergency purchases of coal, and in particular distances, Chairperson, I think the question was, are we being taken for a ride where people elongate the distance they travel so that they can claim more? The answer is no. Because the sources of coal we determine, and how we determine who takes what coal from where, we determine that. A trucker cannot just decide, I'm going to go to the fairest mine, he can't, you know, so that I can get more kilometers. We know where the sources are for which power station, and we monitor that. And we ensure that we're not exposed to any fudging of the issue. So that is something that we monitor very closely. And as when you visit us, you can see how we do it. I've explained the long-term aluminium contracts and how they are evaluated and what are the issues about embedded derivatives. And I think that goes to BHP Billiton. BHP Billiton is the biggest customer that we have on aluminium contracts, and it's the one which has the most impact in terms of embedded derivatives, and we've been in discussion with them. And the issue really is this exposure of commodity link of pricing, which is a problem. And we hope that we'll have a solution that satisfies all of us. The issue of reserves for coal stockpiles. Let me just explain again how this issue evolved. We clearly have an intention to keep minimum stock of 20. What happened around January last year when the stock was depleted? Number of issues. Number one, when you have low stockpiles and you are exposed to heavy rain, you can deplete the stock very, very quickly. Some of our mines are open pit mines. When it rains, their productions are affected. So if you don't watch it carefully and you have adverse weather, you can get exposed. And that's why we got exposed last year. Low stocks and deteriorating weather, low production out of the mines, and we had the situation where some power stations didn't have enough coal. Now, upping it to 41 days is to make sure that we take out that risk. Obviously, when you up it to 41 days, you pay the price in what is called working capital. You increase your working capital. But we believe that working capital is the risk mitigation to make sure that you're not exposed to the variation in stocks. So we believe that's the right approach. The issue of debt that is outstanding, the 286 billion, is clearly incorrect. I mean, 286 billion. It's almost. Let me just give you the extent of this. This year, our revenue, and last financial year, our revenue was 53 billion. Now, 286 billion means we are owed almost five times of our annual revenue. It's incorrect. I think we may talk and find out what the number is, because that is a number that is incorrect. On the nuclear side, I think let me also say that obviously, given the science of nuclear and the cost of nuclear and its implication to the country, it requires an integrated country effort, and hence there is a task team led by the Department of Energy to lead the nuclear procurement. And once all the issues have been dealt with, I think we can begin in earnest to deal with nuclear. But let me also say that the issue of 85% being funded, I mean, it's almost like when you buy a car and somebody says, I will give you 100% loan for that car. It doesn't mean you're not going to pay back that car. It means you're going to pay it. So when they incentivize you to go with them and they say, gets 85% funded. It doesn't mean you only pay 15%. All it means is that 85% you eventually have to pay. It's money that they borrow you, and you have to still answer the question, how am I going to fund this? And these issues are we need to deal with. And I think we should also say, and in conclusion, Chairperson, the investment decisions we are making in the power sector are multi-generational investments. Some of the decisions may look very easy and convenient for now, but they may have unintended consequences that last generations. So in sitting down and making sure that the decisions are fully integrated, we understand the implication, not only for the next 5 years, but for the life of the assets that we are investing in, is important. And nuclear is one of those that has multi-year and multi-generational implications that we should fully appreciate as we move into this investment. Chairperson, I think I'll end there, and I will be in your hands in terms of where to go. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Maruha. Mr. Schmidt, I did not say you can't ask more questions if you want to. You can ask.
Thank you, ma'am. I just want to read out of the annual statement. At the end of March 2009, an amount of $2,767 million. Now, according to me, that's $27 billion. Am I right? 2.7. Work again. According to you, it's 2,767 million. How much billion is that? 2.7? 27. That was the trade debtor that was older than 75 days. If you look at your provision for trade, the other receivables increased by 100 million within the year. That's a lot of money, sir. I just want to come back on what you said on the 41-day stock. You also know that 5 days of those are the treated ones, so the excuse of that they're getting wet is not really accountable. And, sir, it's interesting that while we're all in the middle of a recession, you go and buy 2 billion rand of coal unnecessary. That is for 21 days stock, 2 billion rand. According to your own admission, you are busy working on long-term contracts. You're trying to do away with the short-term contracts. Couldn't we at least have waited and till we're out of the crisis and then buy these coal on the long term, or fill up if you want to go to 41 or 43 days or wherever you want to go? I just think that Eskom is playing on the sentiments of this committee. They're playing on the sentiments of public so that they can get a better increase, that they can get more money, so that they can go into their building program, and I don't think it's fair to the public what you're currently doing without first getting your own house in order. Thank
you. I did not want to cut Mr. Schmidt, because I already said Eskom is going to present their annual report to public enterprises, and hopefully will be allowed to sit in that committee and ask all the questions about the annual report. I'll allow one person now, and then we can close. Okay. All right. Mr. Maruha, thank you very much for accepting our invitation to you. I think it was necessary for you to come to this committee, and you can see the interest from us. We got constituencies that are very poor, and we are answerable to those constituencies. When we come, now will be able to explain why the tariffs have to be increased, if they have to be increased, but will be able to explain to our constituencies. I'm sure that's the interest that Mr. Schmidt has, because he must go and answer to the people. But thank you very much, members. Thank you very much, Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks for the committee for the questions. Thank you.